Okay, so hello everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Doomer Optimism podcast. Today we are going to be talking about the Wendell Berry, The Need to Be Whole book club that we organized kind of loosely through Doomer Optimism Networks on Twitter. A couple of people had talked about this book coming out. It's Wendell Berry's big name within Doomer Optimism. He's got a lot of themes that resonate with people. And this was the most recent book of his that came out. And a lot of people were saying, man, you've got to read this book. It's so good. It's like kind of his magnum opus. And it's a reflection of a lot of his career, but also a reflection of his life's work in conversation with themes that are arising in society today, specifically about like race relations or neighbor relations. So people were saying we should do a Doomer Optimism book club on this. And so I tossed out a tweet like, okay, who wants to join a Doomer Optimism book club? And I assumed it was going to be like the regulars, you know, people who have been on the podcast, like 12 people, and like 150 people were like, sign me up. And I was like, okay, well, this is a whole nother level of organization. And so at first I was just tossing people into a group chat. Then it got too big. Then I got my friend Evan, who I think he's anonymous, so I won't say his name, but he helped me or his handle, but he helped me organize groups by region. And then we had one kind of like Doomer Optimism super group of people who have been on the pod a bunch. And so we organized this book club over the past, I don't know how long, 9 months or something it's been. And it's been really cool. It's been a great opportunity friends with people and sort of deepen relationships. So today we're going to kind of just recap that experience from a few people from the different groups. Tiffany is here from the Midwest group. Joel's here from the Western group, and AC is here from the sort of Doomer Optimism All-Stars group that I was a part of. We might have Keturah show up or Donald show up in this recording at some point too. We're going to just roll with it. So let's start by just kind of recapping briefly the experience you all had from each of your groups. We'll go Tiffany, then Joel, then AC, and then, you know, kind of just kick off the conversation from there. So welcome. And yeah, let's get started. Tiffany, we'll hear your update first.
Yeah. I had the Midwest group. So we had a combination of people from just all over Wisconsin, Illinois, Minnesota. And it was just a really cool experience. We got to, you know, have these deeper conversations and like really talk about, I mean, the book was a lot about race, but it was a lot about land and community and, you know, how those things really intertwine. And so it was a really just very meaningful conversations that were happening. And so that was really nice. We had about, you know, on average, like 4 to 5 people showing up, and we made it about more than halfway through the book. So we made some good progress, but I think summer hit and we kind of, you know, had some people drop off, and it was hard to get coordinated. But I think all in all, it was like a really valuable experience, and good to just really start meeting people that are thinking about these things in kind of our bioregional area.
Yep. Cool. Joel?
Yeah, I was in the West Coast group. We basically had fairly consistently 3 people in our meetings. We made it through the whole group. It was great just to meet up once a month and sort of talk Wendell Berry for an hour and a half. We had varying degrees of familiarity with Wendell Berry's work, but a lot of consistent like longing for that version of community and kind of small scale living.
Yeah. All right, AC, you've got the task of recapping our group.
Representing the super group.
Yeah.
So our group is actually sounds like it was fairly large in comparison. So I'll probably miss some folks, but Ashley, you and Pat, myself, Nate, Josh, Trace, Kara, and Philip Marshall, Donald, and a few others. So we were widely represented from
and Jeff Bilbro and
Jeff Bilbro,
and
thank
Josh
you.
Helling. Yeah.
Yes, thank you. Yeah, so widely represented geographically, you know, from the Upper West to myself in New England, everywhere in between. Widely represented politically too, I would say. That was, you know, noticeable. Like we had very healthy, but certainly like very varied viewpoints from the different political spectrum. We had folks who have been longtime Barry fans, such as myself, certainly Jeff Bilbro, who's essentially a Barry scholar. And then we had sort of Wendell Berry newbies. I think Josh was one and Trace was another. And we did make it through the whole book. I unfortunately sort of had to trail off due to some commitments towards the end, but I think we probably had, I don't know, 10 sessions actually, maybe something like that.
Yeah.
Roughly covering, you know, a chapter a session. And it was really, really healthy conversation. It was, to use an overly used term, it was definitely like a safe space, brave space, right? You know, we pushed up against each other. We had really healthy disagreements and shared different perspectives. So it was an awesome experience.
Yeah, and I would echo that. I want to get into some of the contentious points, but yeah, we'll go through and see if other people had that similar kind of experience. Keturah just popped on. She and Joel were in the same group. I'm wondering, Keturah, if you have any brief reflections. We're just kind of recapping, you know, what the experience was like as an overview, and then, you know, we're going to get into more of the details about kind of what was discussed.
It was a really fun meeting. I'm sorry that Zara can't be here because it seemed like she, Joel, and I don't know, three of us seemed like we were very like integral parts of our meeting. I didn't She provided like a Zoom link for us to use the whole time, and then Joel just always had like a lot of really good thoughts. I feel like I wasn't really even doing that much. I was like always on the road and traveling so much and like scrambling to like get to every single meeting, and technically I was supposed to organize it, but I feel like Zara and Joel really did the bulk of the work for that, for the whole book club, which I don't know, just made it really fun. I definitely enjoyed it.
Cool. Okay, so I think it would be fun now to kind of like dig into, I guess, the details of what were some of the contentious points that came up. And maybe AC, you can help me a little bit kicking this off for our group. I want to make sure I don't misrepresent anyone's point of view, but if I'm to give an overview, I would say there was a kind of left-right schism, typically what you think of as left-right schism between whether or not Barry was kind of holding weight for unfair race relations or something, and kind of trying to explain them away. And obviously, there's a lot of detail in the book about his own history and place. But I guess the big question was, you know, whether or not he was kind of excusing it. And then the secondary question to that to me was I guess what's the upshot of the book? Like, what's the point of or how do we heal race relations or other divisions? And to me, I kind of felt like the point of the book was to provide a philosophy, a philosophical approach to healing those relations, which is to place relationships out of the, I guess, abstract categories and into actual humans, human relationships, like actual one person to another person, as opposed to because I'm in this category, you are therefore in this other category responsible for the thing that's happened to my category. And to me, like any kind of argument that leads to that conclusion is a good thing, personally. You know, to personalize things, to deal with problems on like a scale, a human scale, a scale that matters, a scale that's embedded in place and time and like longevity, is much better and much more complicated than the like sort of flattening categories. But AC, maybe you can help me to like articulate this. I think the counterpoint is that the categories do matter and shouldn't be glossed over, I guess. Yeah. Any thoughts on that? And then we'll.
Yeah, I think, for me at least, I think the book is sort of takes race relations from like a relativist point of view. I think, I think Wendell Berry's argument is that, our the issue of race relations now is kind of a symptom of a greater problem, and a way more complex problem than I think it's addressed, or a way more complex scale than it's addressed today. And I think that the biggest schism that led to the most of our, healthy arguments is probably too strong of a word, but, our disagreements among the group are, those who felt like it was a literal black and white problem. Like it's a simple problem. Race relations like stand on its own. And there were other folks who, maybe there was the folks who were more familiar with Berry's work, who understood the type of argument that he was making. He was trying to put race relations into the bigger picture of, our relationship with our communities, our relationship with place, our relationship with agriculture and work. And so that's, I think, where we had the most tension. It was sort of like a disagreement in the simplicity or complexity of the problem. I don't know if that sort of resonates with you, Ashley, if you sort of picked up on it that way, but that was kind of my take.
Yep. I would agree with that. Although I just want to say the caveat that AC and I were usually on the same side. So you're not getting the other side's perspective from their own mouths. So I just want to put that caveat out there. But yeah, we're going to have an easier time describing the argument from our perspective than probably the other side, who maybe would understand the way that they were arguing it differently. I just want to put that caveat out there. Anyone else want to talk on this topic? Was it a point of contention, the question of race relations in America? Did you have disagreements? How did it go?
I think in our group there wasn't as much contention, but there was definitely a feeling of, I guess, discomfort in, it wasn't a super diverse group, I guess, with the few people that we had. And so I think we all kind of had a respectful conversation of, it was interesting to explore these ideas, but also there was that just discomfort of, are we the people that should be having this conversation? And, how do we bring more people into a conversation like that? Was, I think, a question that arose.
Yeah. Couture or Joel?
I guess we I don't think we had a lot of really serious disagreements or contention in our group. There was a lot of it was fascinating, sort of the places that the three of us tended to overlap and the places where we were coming from different spots. I feel like Keturah and I had sort of a bit of a religious sensibility overlap, and Azar and I had sort of a almost inverse sort of like experiences of our backgrounds, just in terms of like ideologically and demographically, like where we were coming from. She's sort of like an immigrant kid that grew up in a small town and followed the kind of progressive lifestyle into a big city and academia. And I was like a religiously conservative homeschooled kid. so that was a fascinating sort of like the similarities and differences in our group. And as far as the race question specifically, we were in a similar place to Tiffany, kind of like, I don't know that we're actually the right group of people to be solving or asking all of these questions. They're interesting questions, sort of trying to tread lightly. We tended to talk more about the history, the kind of, trying to engage with Wendell Berry's arguments and bring our own experience into it. But we didn't have as much, I don't know, that wasn't as much a topic of disagreement as some of the other things we got into.
Okay, I want to ask you about the other things, other points of disagreement in a second, but I want to stay on this. So think about what you're going to say to that, because I'm curious to dig into where there were points of disagreement. But let's stick on this for a second. Is Wendell Berry, a white man, allowed to write a book about race relations in America? Is he allowed to? Is the first question. I don't know if anyone, if you guys like dug into that question, but I personally think, you know, anyone's allowed to talk about any topic. There's no like, I don't get to even talk about it or even discuss if I'm not in some sort of category. To me, that's like part of that flattened category thinking, which is just like, if you fit into, it's like, you know, I'm going to say it, spreadsheet brain, like if you fit into some sort of spreadsheet, whatever, like the algorithm determines you fit into some sort of spreadsheet model, you get to talk about certain topics and other people don't. Like my perspective is that anyone can talk about any topic, as long as they're doing it, you know, with an open heart and an open mind and doing it to gain understanding. Like there really is no solution but to talk about these things. But I can understand the you know, just, okay, he gets to talk about it, but like, let's think about where he's coming from as like an old white man or whatever. That's fine. But yeah, did you guys, I want to hear your thoughts on that topic.
Yeah, I think part of the reason why I think it's okay is because Wendell Berry already talks a lot about community and like how to like return to your place in your home. And so it's a very relevant topic in that aspect. And it's part of like what I focused a lot when I was reading the book. I wasn't really focusing on like prejudices and I mean like in the aspect of like races. I was like mostly focusing on like how can I use this information to become a better community builder in general,
right,
regardless of any of these differences that the book was specifically focusing on. And I think that's part of why Wendell Berry, like in some ways, like I was with Joel and like I didn't necessarily feel like it was completely in my area of authority to like have much to say or think about it. But at the same time, as a community builder, I have things I can learn from it. And as a community builder from Wendell Berry's perspective, I think he has things to say on it and that those things are valid and worth listening to.
Yeah. Anyone else?
I think too, in like Wendell Berry has more context for that conversation than I do, just in terms of where he is regionally and his own history. And so that was sort of interesting too. Like I think he's very good at situating everything he's saying in his own personal context.
Mm-hmm.
And but there are the sort of I think a lot of the really substantive conversations our group had were where our own experience was sort of confronting Wendell Berry's stated experience of the world and how it works, and sort of trying to look underneath the limitations that he's bringing from his own context in terms of other perspectives that we've either read or been through ourselves or know people.
Yeah. Great point. AC, do you have anything on this?
I think there was definitely members of our group who felt, I think it was actually even said out loud, like this is a book on white, on race relations targeted at white folks, which is probably not all that far from the truth. But I think, you know, going with building on what Joel was saying, you know, I think regardless, like it was very genuine. Like I feel, you know, Wendell Berry again speaks from a place. I think he would certainly hesitate to say that like what I am saying applies everywhere. I think we all would agree that Wendell Berry would not feel that way, and so it came across as specifically genuine. And in fact, like he talked a lot about, you know, the history of his home state Kentucky and its involvement in the Civil War. And, you know, he just added so many layers of context that were hyper local. You know, I personally felt like It's hard to interpret his work as like broadly applied. You know, like his suggestions are not one size fits all. It was deeply embedded in his place, and so for me, I think he can talk about race. He was very much talking about race relations in his own firsthand experience. So that was my takeaway.
Tiffany, anything else to add on that?
I mean, I just like that he brought like a deeper complexity to, I guess, the Civil War in general, and just got me thinking a lot about, you know, other issues and other things that came as a result of that. Whereas I've tended to more think about the singular issue of race when it comes to the Civil War, and to see, you know, to really think about like the impact of industrial society that came out of that really gave me, I don't know, not deeper meaning, but just deeper thought into, you know, where we've come since then.
Yep, totally. I see Donald is joining from the Doomer Optimism account, which is very funny that I'm not on that account and he is. But we'll let him join for a second. One thing that comes to mind when we're all talking is this, like, hey, Donald, this Ivan Illich attitude that, like we don't have to be experts in something to be able to have like a thought on it. And it's okay to be messy or to talk about things in your specific context that aren't necessarily able to be universalizable. Man, I'm forgetting English. I've got to get better at English before I go back to Chicago. Anyways, so yeah, this whole idea that it's okay for things to be messy in context, for us to have a more complicated view of history. I think that was a big lesson from this book. You know, I think the very flattened view of history in the Civil War is questioned in this book. Donald, we're kind of just going around talking about points of contention, but the question that we're currently on is, does a white man get to write a book about race? Do you have any thoughts on that from our book club?
I don't understand the question.
Are we allowed to talk about it? Should we feel self-conscious? Okay, if it's a white guy writing it and it's all white people in the group, are we allowed to talk about it? Or do we... Is there something weird?
I don't understand. Allowed by whom?
You know what I'm saying.
Why can't you write and talk about your life? I don't know. Seems
We have your answer.
Who would possibly answer no?
Well, some people would, because they would say, okay, well, like, we're talking about potentially other races' experiences, and they're not ours. And so, I mean, part of your answer.
So the question, can ought one to talk, to speak, or write about anyone else besides yourself?
Right. Of course you can.
Obviously you can. And so if Wendell Berry's trying to make sense of his life and his work and the history of Kentucky, you know, this is part of it. So, of course, he's going to write about it.
Yeah, as you can see, Donald was the I guess Molotov cocktail tosser in our group. I think
I don't think anything I just said was particularly contentious.
Yes, it was. AC, go ahead. What were you going to say?
I was just going to say he's the monotone agitator.
Monotone agitator. Oh my God, that's so perfect. But yeah, no, I mean, I agree with that point, but other people, I would say, you know, just questioned that. And yeah, there was kind of this tension, I think, between, like, to me, the frustrating part, and of course, I'm representing my own point of view, is the end point of thinking about categories or thinking about people as categories is more and more flattening and more like contention. The end point of thinking about people more in context is like more and more empathy and understanding and like complicated. But to me, those are the kind of like dual extremes that we kind of had or exist, I think. And it's a little it's like sociologists have really messed us up on this. Like, what does this category think of this? And it's like, now we're required to think about people as categories and statistics.
I mean, my contention with the book is I thought the strongest parts of the book were where he talked about people he knew and places he knew and his own life. And the weakest parts of the book were when he didn't follow that and he spoke in more general terms.
Mm.
So it's a hard, you know, I think it's a good thing to attempt to do, speak about things concretely and directly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I would say
the book was much stronger in the parts where he did that.
And I guess the more we talk about it, the more he's sort of not only telling, but showing, like modeling, talking about things in context, specific relationships with real, like individual people even, or stories from the Civil War of individual people that kind of demonstrate something more complex than the flattened reality. I guess now that there's enough people here, we can kind of just jump in without me calling on anyone. So anything else on this topic? Otherwise, I was going to put Joel on the spot to tell us some other points of disagreement they had in their group. Anything else on this topic? Okay, Joel, you're up.
I guess I'll caveat the points of disagreement. A lot of them were points of conflict with Wendell Berry more than with each other necessarily. And to jump on Donald's last point, like the places that I tended to have the most issue with seem to be the places where Wendell Berry was generalizing groups of people or experiences or the media or history or whatever it was, in ways that that seemed to sort of like counteract a lot of his previous work, I kept feeling frustrated that he had done a better job of making his argument in previous books than he did in this one. A lot of those places were when he was making generalities or societal observations or kind of larger scale arguments. So some of them were, you know, he's talking about monuments or sculptures being removed. I'm trying to think of some of the other really bigger, if Katura wants to jump in and help me remember any of the other points we made. There were a few themes we kept circling back to in terms of just like, how far back are you going in the history that you're talking about and sort of taking issue with? Mm. I think also like his characterization of industrialism versus the agrarian. And I actually wished he'd gone sort of further back in history around, like in some ways, I think slavery was more a product of the industrial mentality than he sort of like talked about. You're like turning people into little machines that do your work for you, which is sort of it's like so that the scope of your reach can be extended beyond yourself, which is sort of counteracts the agrarian ideal that he argues in a lot of the rest of his books of the small farm and the local place. And I sort of wished he'd confronted that side of things more. So I don't mean to trail off. I can
No, that's fine. That's fine. We brought up a few themes. Anyone want to jump in on any of those themes? Donald?
I mean, it'd been interesting if he talked about slavery goes back since time immemorial, right? So as a prehistory, slavery, there seems to have been slavery as long back as we have records of human activity, I think. So, I don't know. It's interesting when you contrast slavery in Kentucky to slavery in other places. And I think, you know, Frederick Douglass talked when he was a slave in the city of Baltimore. It's interesting that the urban industrial, like you were saying, and slavery weren't totally at odds at all. Like Douglass at one point was renting his own apartment as a slave. I mean, it's working at a shipyard, but then had to, his wages were given to his owner.
Hmm.
Which is kind of like the worst of all worlds.
Yeah.
It also gave him the relative independence to plot his escape. So it's, I don't know. I mean, I really saw the book as like a sort of summing up of Wendell Berry's life and him grappling with the Southern agrarian ideas of his teachers, which he still clearly held, and trying to tie it all together in a not particularly well-ordered way. I mean, it was kind of one of the fun things of the book is it just, you know, it's everything in the kitchen sink.
Yep. Anybody else want to jump in? Okay, I have a couple of topics we can jump into. Okay, so first of all, the one topic was a lot of the book was ordered by like sins or religious sensibilities. And it was really interesting because we had a few, we didn't mention AC, that Dave was in the group too. We had gone through and listed some of the people in our Doomer Optimism group. And it was interesting to see like the non-religious group members grappling with the religious, very explicitly religious sensibility of some of the chapters. Did you all have that kind of thing? I mean, Joel and Keturah, you guys are both religious. So were you in agreement on that kind of framing? You know, did you have that kind of tension in your group?
Yeah, I mean, I feel like the religious sensibilities were more familiar to, it felt familiar. Whereas Azar was kind of like intrigued but mystified by a lot of the religious language and the religious framing. Mm. My favorite, I think the talking about monuments was one of the places where Keturah was sort of like, yeah, like monuments are just false idols, like to the state. Like we, and I was like, yeah, cool. Like, let's go Anabaptist. Like that's, and Azar was like, what do you, like, we need to unpack this. Cause I'm not in that whole.
I mean, let's get into the monuments discussion. Maybe as a part of this religious discussion, Donald, did you have something you want to add?
Well, hey, Tiffany. I don't think I've ever met you before.
Oh yeah, Tiffany, meet Donald. Tiffany is representing the Midwest group.
Oh, nice. I'm from the Midwest.
We're not making this another episode about Ohio, Donald. Stop
trying. Let's just talk about Ohio and Kentucky the whole time.
I was born in Ohio, too.
Oh, God. Don't encourage him.
This is a great group. I feel really at home now. The monuments. Yeah, I mean... trying to throw my mind back. I think there were big disagreements about the monuments. I don't know. I think the tearing down the monuments is like, I don't think he was harsh enough. I mean, harsh is not his manner. So, you know.
Critical.
To me, the tearing down the monuments is an expression of a hatred of the past. Not anything about like actually helping people in the present. And I mean, his story about the tobacco company, the monument at Duke of the tobacco company man who had just really directly harmed the place where he lived and his family and his neighbors and so on, and not wanting that statue taken down. And surely most people are going to have a very tenuous, if any, direct connection to all these various statues, some of which are pretty absurd, like he pointed out a couple. But I don't think that the the actual content of the statue matters very much. I could be wrong about that. I think that the statues are just sort of a physical representation of the past, and the desire was to just attack and destroy that.
Mm-hmm. AC, did you have something you want to add?
Yeah, I think we definitely had some passionate discussions about the monuments, but to me, like, I think his argument against the removal of monuments, excuse me, is sort of tied into his what I think is the greater argument, which is, you know, sin in general and our sort of gross oversimplification of sin as like a tool for our misguided attempt to like eradicate sin altogether. Mm. Right. So, you know, he talks about the concept of very few public sins, right? Racism being one of them, which obviously is a central core of the book. You know, I think he tried to criticize the concept of like, okay, let's abolish slavery and then sin will be eradicated. Oh, that didn't work. Let's take down all of the monuments and that sin will be eradicated. Oh, that didn't quite work either. Let's completely eliminate racism altogether and eradicate the sin. And come to find out, that is a gross oversimplification to the detriment of race relations itself. You know, and I think, you know, the monuments, the presence of monuments is a reminder of sinfulness, right? That I think he would say is necessary to put the whole in perspective. The central theme to me was like, let he without sin cast the first stone, you know, and again, the concept of very simple, oversimplified public sins. Well, at least I don't say things that can be construed to be racist, therefore I'm a good person, mm-hmm. right? I don't need to worry about those other many sins, which are between you and God and between you and your neighbor that in fact we probably should focus on more, right? Just because we eradicate or attempt to eradicate the sin of slavery or the remembrance of slavery or the race relations that have come out of those two things, those two previous things, does not mean that you are a sinless person, right? So to me, it all sort of tied together.
Yep. Yep. Just to recap, thinking about, I think some of the flattened nature of the way race relations or just societal relations in general are conducted now is whether or not somebody is a good person or a bad person and which team they're on, as opposed to approaching the perspective of sin as is, you know, generally constituted, which is that we're all constantly sinners and constantly asking for forgiveness. We're not like absolved because we're a part of a team for all time, no matter what, because we have the right view or whatever. But instead, it's like it's an ongoing, constant striving, if that resonates. Tiffany, any thoughts on the religious aspect of or the monuments?
Not so much on the monuments, but I mean, our group was pretty religious, I think, in general, or familiar with Wendell Berry's work. And so there's definitely a lot of consensus there. And I feel like I maybe was the most rebellious of the group in that, in my thinking. I mean, just, I don't know, I appreciated the viewpoints that he brought to the table and that others in our group brought to the table. And like the one thing I kind of struggled with was, well, kind of struggled and also, I guess, appreciated was, you know, the idea of, you know, the commandment, you know, honor your father and mother and what that, you know, a deeper meaning to that of how, you know, something in a concept like that is how we pass on tradition and how we create bloodlines and we create, you know, community and things like that. And so kind of gave me a wider perspective on that commandment, I guess, and also something I struggle with because, you know, if what you're getting passed down is not necessarily the wisest things, then how do you do that? You don't want to just take whatever is given to you, you know, how do you you find the people that are wise, you know, in this world, and you know, keep alive the traditions and keep alive the things that are really good mm-hmm. and meaningful, and bring those forward, as especially as you know we are sending our next generation of people into the world and what they're going to have to deal with.
Mm-hmm. Donald?
I thought that's interesting about the thinking the book in terms of that commandment. And I think what Barry was great on and very persuasive, which is that, okay, we have an imperfect social order, but nonetheless one in which people actually know and work together, and that is maintaining that scale, even if it is unjust, at least creates the possibility of a just community, and destroying that scale erases any possibility. So destroying like anything that is human scale is going to be full of prejudices and bigotries and, you know, confusion and
exploitation,
you know, all of the lying, all of the stuff of human, you know, human frailty, sinfulness. But if it's on that scale where you actually know your neighbors and work together and rely on each other, and not just out of choice, but because you really actually need each other, that creates the possibility of something just. Whereas if you, in the name of destroying those prejudices and so on, destroy that scale of life, then you're left with no possibility of a just community, because there's no community at all. And so it's a challenge, you know, if you have utopia, you know, there's no utopian magic government policy or something, like there's trade-offs to all of this. And I think that his challenge that he's putting forward is that whatever problems there were with specifically the kind of agrarian society that he got to see a little bit of in Kentucky, and that his dad and grandpa got to see more of, whatever problems there were, it was at a scale that made human community possible,
mm-hmm.
and that is preferable with the problems to, you know, what we have now.
Mm-hmm.
And at least, yeah, that scale allows for people to know each other, and in knowing each other to actually share a life. Like I kept thinking about Faulkner's famous line, which is like in the North, like Northern racism is blacks can get as big as they want as long as they don't get too close, and the South is they can get as close as they want as long as they don't get too big.
Mm.
I think for Barry, that closeness and the sharing of life that happened in the South had the kernel of a sort of just community.
Mm-hmm.
And so the South becomes both the root of American problems, namely the divorce from the land and the hatred of labor that was codified in slavery, but then also in Southern agrarian culture, the root of a future possibility, which I think at this point in his life, Barry's very pessimistic about.
Yeah.
Like the book's mostly an elegy and a record of someone who fought and lost.
Yeah. I would just add one thing that kept coming up for me, or keeps coming up still, is I think so many people, because we've outscaled a lot of, you know, community or societal issues to the government, welfare state, laws, corporations, like the way we interact with each other, and, you know, it gets moderated through these various totally outscaled institutions. And so people tend to think then that like the only solution to these problems are at that scale. Like, you know, we just need, you know, more free marketism, more laws that protect people. But there are just certain things like decency, human culture, the ability to forgive, the ability to work together, that just cannot get outsourced to laws or the market. There's certain things that just only happen at the scale of civil society. And I see this everywhere now that I have kind of flagged it for myself reading this book and for, in other ways, just that the fabric of civil society is just completely essential. And there's certain parts of it that it cannot be codified in these like outscaled institutions. They just cannot be translated. You can't control people that way. There has to be something bottom up forcing it. So to me, the religious part was really interesting with that. And I also kind of came to the realization that a lot of our like moral drive, whether or not we want to be actively practicing religion in the West, is mostly Judeo-Christian. And we have a lot of like codified morality that's just, you know, built around that. I don't know. No question there, just a thought. I'm curious, AC, if as a fellow non-observant religion person, how did the religious part hit for you of this book?
Yeah, for me, it being familiar enough with Barry's work and the religious undertones of his work, I mean, it felt comfortable, I guess that would be the word that I used. And like I said, you know, my favorite chapter in the book was sin, and I think obviously there was some deep religious undertones there. So for me, it was no issue whatsoever. And I would say even for our group, with the exception of some of the things that you mentioned, Ashley, like I think even the non-religious members of our group, you know, grasped it just fine. I don't think it was a turnoff in any way, or something that they particularly struggled with.
Yep. I would agree, and I'm curious, maybe Joel or Donald, as religious people, what your take was. But at least for a couple of people on Twitter, John Dios and Neil, they kind of like never read Wendell Berry, so they want to just make fun of him. But they say like Wendell Berry is, you know, religion for libs or that kind of thing. He finds a way to make religion palatable to people who are probably not religious. But I mean, to me, it just made me want to become more religious, really, because it's like this framework is there and it feels super comfortable. Donald?
I mean, it's for everyone. So, you know.
Join us. Joel?
Not just the fact that, I mean, I don't know. It was funny reading it because, you know, I sometimes would like quibble with the way he would like read a Bible passage or something, you know. But I think the fact that he's, you know, open to the spiritual life and encouraging people in that direction is a good thing.
Mm-hmm. Joel, anything to add?
Yeah, it's interesting to me the way Wendell Berry sort of rubs up against organized religion when it, like, I'm not even sure how to phrase this, but he's sort of the forest religious observer. Like, he's like a mystic communitarian Christian, kind of, like, who's a bit anti-institutional about the whole his own religious experience.
Mm-hmm.
But it is interesting that he doesn't, he most of his religious observance seems to be very individualistic. Like, he doesn't talk about his community experience of religion very much, which I haven't really given it a lot of thought, but always kind of surprises me. Because I think his, in some ways, his writing about community actually has caused me to think a lot more about like how should community actually function within religious observance, because it is such a potential vehicle for community transformation, community engagement. But yeah, the irony of Wendell Berry being kind of this individualistic, anarcho-mystic Christian.
Donald, anything on that?
Well, Tiffany, I'm curious if you could talk more about what you were saying about honoring father and mother. You said, what did you call yourself? You said that you were kind of a rebel, but something like that in your group. What do you mean by that?
I did say rebellious. I grew up in a Christian home. And so, you know, I grew up with those ideas. And I think that I've pushed back against that and, you know, said, no, you know, we're going to find our own way. And, you know, I'm going to make my own ideas. And it's funny because my grandfather grew up on a farm and, you know, so he was part of this migration, that this great migration that, you know, occurred to the cities and to city life. And so, you know, I grew up in more suburb city life also. And, you know, it's just interesting to think about, you know, how things would have been very different had, you know, my family stayed in that kind of a lifestyle. And, you know, had we passed down traditions like that, and, you know, that strong Christian kind of background definitely, you know, came through. And I feel like this group really gave me more of an appreciation for it, and for, you know, the values that I maybe took for granted, that I was, you know, taught early on, and, you know, how you can really, you know, how things that I want to pass on to my own kids, especially, you know, like what are the values now, like as I come more back to the land in a way, I'm still, you know, in an urban environment, but, you know, coming back to values and coming back to land. And when you have kids, it really makes you think about that. Like, what are you passing on to them? So I think it was overall just a really valuable conversations to have.
Mm-hmm. You have something you want to add, Donald?
I'm tempted to say that another weakness for Berry is his disconnection from Christian history and tradition. That I think, just from the little I know about him, I think his wife Tanya talks about being involved in like the local Baptist church, because that's where everyone, that's like what there is in their county. But I think that he's not. Like, he clearly has a, you know, he's kind of like a mystic wandering in the woods by himself or something. Of which there is a fine
tradition
in the church of, you know, saints wandering around the woods preaching to bears and that kind of thing. But there were a few, I think, as I said earlier, the best parts of the book is where he's talking about his own life and people he knows and places he knows. There were some times when he would set up these, like the conservative Christian as like an unnamed interlocutor. And I was always like, he has to know like at least 100 people who could be roughly described that way, but he doesn't argue with anyone in particular. He argues with this sort of stand-in straw man. And I don't think he did a good job of, he was weirdly, like didn't seem to understand the motivations or arguments there. I don't know why he made that choice to argue against with an abstraction instead of, you know, a flesh and blood person like he could have. But maybe that would have ruined, you know, if he had been like, it would just been, he would be a different person. It would be a different book.
Yeah.
If he was constantly like quoting the Desert Fathers or doing something annoying like I would do.
Well, and he might, yeah, I mean, he might be trying to think about a certain audience, and maybe it is like a white guy writing about race for white people. whatever, you know, and trying to.
Well, that's such an impoverished description.
I know.
I mean, to even like allow ourselves to think on such a.
No, but even. I think it is true. I think it is true that he's probably. I think the critique that he's for libs is actually probably true. He has cultivated an audience of people, I think, who maybe aren't actively religious, but like are open to the sensibility. And therefore, he's kind of like, you know,
he's a popular writer. The reality is that he's a popular writer.
Yeah.
So it was a large audience.
Yeah.
It was rare. And he is the rare, very rare writer who writes poetry, essays, and fiction well. So he's a real, he's one of, you know, our great writers of our country.
Yeah.
And you know, he's still putting out big books at this age. I mean, it's a real blessing to get to, and still writing fiction too, to be able to read him and to live at the same time as him, I think.
Yep.
Does he write for libs? Sure. I mean, I don't know what his book sales are exactly, but I think that he, you know, he's had a long writing career.
Yeah,
he's written a lot of books, but are some of which have sold pretty well, and he's read by lots of people.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I mean, like, my wife's from Kentucky, and he's a really beloved writer there.
Yeah, you're right. Kentucky. I mean, I don't think he's just for libs. I mean, part of the reason he is so popular is I think he really is quite American, and also quite of Kentucky, but also like. I think part of it is that he just complicates things and makes things he's not like a conservative Christian writer or a NPR, you know, writer for the NPR set or anything. And because he specifically complicates things and is a deep thinker, obviously.
When we live in such a degraded time that, you know, it doesn't take that much to rise above it, but I think that he's been a fine writer for many decades and would have been a fine writer in any era.
I want to end after this question with a practical question about, you know, relationships built from the actual book club. But before then, I want to spring on you what you think the title means. What does it mean, the need to be whole, after having gone through the book and had this whole range of conversations. Who's ready to take a stab at that?
I feel like we had some really nice conversations about that. I really appreciated the religious aspects in our group, because we could have these deep talks and everything. And you know, just moving towards the need to be whole, I guess, was just being, I think that the one thing that really stuck with me was the idea of just being in the world in a way of love, and like what that means and how we connect to our environment, how we pay attention to our environment, like at what scale we can do that, and how we connect to, I mean, the people in our environment, most importantly. And so I feel like that was really just a meaningful part of the conversation for me.
Yeah.
And so like being more, you know, in a way of love, you know, leads to wholeness. I guess for me, that was my big takeaway.
Love it. AC, you ready?
Yeah, I think I touched on it a little bit earlier, but you just said that he complicates things. And I would push back a little bit on that. I would think he highlights the complexity of things, right? So these simple sins that we think are, you know, quite literally in this case, black and white, are not so simple. And he points out the myriad ways in which they're not so simple. And in any complex system, you need to treat the problem holistically, literally holistically, the need to be whole. And yet he would not argue for broad brush approaches. I think he argues simultaneously for a holistic perspective but a localistic addressing of the issue, right? And one of my favorite quotes from the whole book, it's actually not his, but it's a quote that he used in the book. I think he was quoting William Blake, I think. Something like, if you're to do good to another person, it must be in minute particulars, and that the general good, quote unquote, is the plea of the scoundrel, hypocrite, and flatterer, I think was the third word he used. But to me, that was like perfect. Like, you need to address the problem holistically. You need to acknowledge the myriad problems that affect small in particular problems, but you need to address those things on the ground, in the minute in particular, like in your everyday life. You must be good to your neighbor, right? I think that's what it all sort of comes down to. And if we were all just better to our neighbors, then the whole system would be that much better, right? So that was kind of the whole quote unquote theme for me.
Joel or Donald?
I think in this book, and as sort of a summary of sort of his entire catalog of work, is this kind of like integrating or not allowing aspects of your life to be obscured from each other. Kind of your work is connected to your community, is connected to your family, is connected to your beliefs, is connected to your politics, is connected to your neighbor, is connected to the land that you're, all of those things exist on. And once we can start to like see how all of those things are actually connected, and respect that the connections matter, and that that we're dependent on all of those connections to keep existing and to be sustained, then you get to a place where you actually do sort of like are capable of loving the connections, like Tiffany was talking about, where you having integrating the aspects of your life that are sort of systemically obscured from each other by the systems we're all sort of inside.
Mm-hmm. I Tiffany, I think the focus on love, I think, is very clear in the book. And love requires fidelity. So I thought one of the beautiful things of the book was it was really an expression of fidelity by Barry to his teachers and the tradition that formed him and the place that formed him and his family and his friends. He comes back again and again to various friends that he knew and who helped shape him and his thinking. So in both his words, and then he's also like in how he writes and what he writes, he's showing us how to maintain that, how he has maintained that fidelity across his life. He's not just like preaching it to us, but he's clearly done it himself. And fidelity isn't always easy, you know. Like if you insist on fidelity to a place and to a particular place and a particular people, that's, you know, doesn't mean that the place is going to necessarily be like just and beautiful all the time, but that in order to actually do something good there, like that the fidelity is a precondition, I think, for Barry, for human community.
Okay, I would just add that so when you guys were all talking, I was thinking about this, a very sociological take, historical materialist take, but it feels like industrial society has kind of broken us from these, you know, I guess, embedded communities, like relationship, like the necessary relationship with nature, the necessary relationship when you don't have too much wealth, you kind of need to rely on other people, and therefore you kind of have to make it work in community. Whereas if you have, you know, obscene amounts of wealth, you can just kind of outsource your needs by buying things. And so I'm just reminded of the subtitle of my book, which is also like a theme in a lot of sociology, this tripart work, nature, and community, these three aspects of social life, basically, that got interrupted from the industrial society, and the what it would take to kind of re-embed in those different aspects. So that to me is the whole part. And like you were saying, Joel, that these things are all connected to each other too. So yeah, that's just reinforced a lot of those thoughts for me, which is why I like Barry so much. He's, you know, basically preaching to the choir with that topic. Okay, so kind of a
mess. Can I say one other thing?
Yeah, also, please.
The part of the book that really convicted me was the work chapter. Just like of how lazy I am, you know, and how kind of not useless, but relatively useless, I guess. And there were a couple of meetings of our group. I don't know if you were there for them, Ashley. It was really just a couple of us. And we talked about through the work chapter, and we talked about our own work or lack of work. It was interesting to try to use the text as a way to talk about that frankly. And you know, a lot of people have had a desire to do more meaningful work or more work or a different kind of work, and trying to figure out practically, you know, how to do that.
Yeah.
AC, do you have something that came out in the discussions of that chapter, which I think in our group was by far the favorite chapter. Again, AC like the sin chapter, but I think the most people, the work chapter was really the favorite. Even the people who disliked the book up until that chapter
liked that really chapter. AC, something to add there?
No, I thought you were going to ask me a question. Sorry.
No, yeah, I was just going to say, do you have anything to say on the work chapter? Were you at that meeting?
I was not, sadly, and that was one of my favorite chapters, and I'm frantically trying to thumb through it, looking for inspiration at the moment. But
no, yeah, I mean, for me, the work thing, and this is like what my research found too, is like a lot of people get into, for example, my dissertation research was people who produce food in their, you know, backyards, and a lot of people get into it because they just feel so alienated from the work that they're doing day to day. Like, what am I doing? It's just bullshit jobs, you know. It's just like I don't even know how I can't see in any way that I'm productive. And it's just like even cliche to say at this point, but a lot of people just get into this, any kind of, you know, like homesteading type stuff or home economics type stuff, just to like know that they can do things with their hands or that they're like capable in some way. And you can't really blame them. I mean, it's really unforeseen the outcome of industrial society and massive affluence, that people would just be like sad and depressed because they're not that useful, or practically useful or like in a physical, tangible way. And I think a lot of people are realizing that even if they don't have the words to say it, and grappling with like, what does that mean practically? Like, how can they, remedy that basically in their lives? Anything?
I joked with my wife this year that our garden is a very mixed year in the garden. Like a maple tree sent roots into a lot of our stuff. So like our potatoes were a bust pretty much. And I joked with my wife, like, if this was real life, you know, we're starving this winter, or I guess like living on squirrels or deer or something.
Well, and it's so funny, Donald,
it's just a hobby, it's not real life.
No, I know, but you had this poem once that you were making fun of Doomer Optimism, and you said like, we grow the most expensive potatoes in the world. And I think one of the funniest things I've ever read, because like just time wise and how unsuccessful like a modern useless person is, it really is like a complete hobby that's just expensive and makes no economic sense at all, but it's still just like we're pigheadedly doing this stuff because we just want to know that we can do something. And like, and the skills can build and you can get more capable over time, et cetera. And you want to teach your kids how to be capable so they don't end up in the same situation, et cetera. But it literally is the most expensive, like most expensive eggs, most expensive potatoes.
Paul Wheaton wrote something great recently where he's comparing the sort of person who comes to his workshops learning how to do permaculture with a unskilled farmhand that like a farm would hire.
Yeah.
And how basically the unskilled farmhand is like doing at least four times, capable of doing at least four times as much work unsupervised,
yeah,
than the average person who comes to these workshops. And he goes like, you know, he goes through all these different abilities, like you know, able to use a tractor, just like, and by the end of it, it's just like how pitiful someone, and then these are motivated people who are coming and like, you know, trying to learn about permaculture and do things, versus like the most entry level.
Oh, I have to tell you this.
Person who grew up doing farm work, you know.
I know AC has to say something, but I have to tell you this because it's funny. I know this sociologist who developed a study to like basically study this phenomenon, and I'm just thinking like, you must be joking. This is like, you're just basically making fun of these people. The study was taking regular people out to pick industrial strawberries and having them take selfies throughout the whole process and putting them to work next to like the actual pickers. And at the beginning, they're all like taking pictures as if it's like, and they did like this analysis of it as if it's like this cool, beautiful, like connection with nature. And by the end, they're like all sweaty. They put like their shirts over their heads and stuff and how like ridiculous they look. How much hard work it is, how much they didn't really realize. And then they did like a whole analysis of these people. And I was just like, yeah, we're that, you didn't have to do a whole study on that. We're pretty much, we know. But it was such a funny study that they developed that way. Okay, AC.
Yeah, you put me on the spot earlier on the work insights, and I found a highlight that I have like triple starred and highlighted, and the word spicy written in the column. But I think it's, you know, it's indicative of what I love about Wendell Berry, which is like he so eloquently pops the bubble of sort of modern pretentiousness, if you will. And if I can read it, maybe it's boring to read, but I'll read it if that's okay. He says, work that is done on too large a scale and that goes on the same day after day for too long a time, work in which the worker makes only a part and not the whole of a made thing, work that is poorly compensated and unthanked, work for the benefit only of strangers, work that does harm to the world and other creatures, work that is done too fast and is poorly done, work that is ugly in the doing and in the result, work that one does only because one is obliged or compelled to do it, or that one must do because it is the only work available. Such work may properly be thought a curse and may receive curses in response. Such work may cause people to think slave thoughts and adopt slave ways. Thank God it's Friday is a slave thought. That's the part I had to underline. But, you know, to me, that's it right there. That's work in a nutshell, like what we have come to know work as. And sort of our cushy middle classness, and in opposition to the work that we look down to and call physical toil. You know, there's sort of an inverse there that a lot of people don't consider. So
yeah,
that was a good example of him bursting that bubble.
Yep. Any final thoughts on the content of the book before we do a quick meta wrap up of what it was like, with our fellow book club attendees? Any other things you guys?
I have a question for everybody. This is the quandary for me. Why does Berry not talk about civil rights and like the Great Society and all of the big, like he talks about stuff before that and stuff after that, but it was this weird, conspicuously absent thing that really presumably transformed the part of Kentucky he's from in some way, like all the things that happened with LBJ in the 60s and so on, and that carry on in a big way still. Does anyone have any thoughts on how that could possibly just never be mentioned at all in the book?
I didn't think about that at all when I read the book, Donald, until you brought that same question up in one of our sessions. And then all of a sudden I was originally happy with the book, and then I was disappointed with the book, because I would like to hear him comment on that. I would suspect that he has some probably well-pointed criticisms, but I would like to know what those would be. But to answer your question, I don't know why he didn't address that. That's a great question.
Joel?
I was pretty frustrated with the absence of talk about Reconstruction and the implementation of Jim Crow after the Civil War also. I mean, he just sort of, and I would guess he didn't touch on those things for similar reasons. But I have no idea what the scope of, didn't want to write a 3,000 page book.
Yeah, and I almost feel like it was like the modern way people think about race relations, and then that in like contextualized by what we think of as, like, I guess the seed of those relations, which is like the Civil War. So complicating that, and then bringing that into the future. But there's like so much between those periods, yeah, that, I mean, yeah, I guess space limitations too. But what do you think, Donald? You don't know.
I mean, I guess it just seems like we live, the American regime is totally shaped by civil rights. Like the federal government today is the one that was sort of begun in the 1930s, and then really the New Deal project was fully expanded in the 1960s. So that's the regime we live in. Like there's all these three-letter agencies.
Yeah.
And so on. And like that's the American regime. And so in talking about the 19th century as much as he does, I mean, it's a lot. I don't know. I mean, that's definitely a preoccupation of the Southern agrarians and the tradition that he was raised in, to be really focused on the 19th century. And I can understand, like, he has to put forward this twin idea of the South, of the root of American problems and the possible path out.
Mm-hmm.
He has to go early. But I don't know. It seems like a strange, you can kind of get the impression of what he thinks.
Yeah.
Reading between the lines, I think, pretty clearly. But I don't know. Maybe there was another chapter that the publisher
cut out.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
It's, the book was not printed with his usual publisher. I think that's also interesting.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, so we're running kind of short on time, so I want to wrap up. I know Tiffany has some thoughts on this, so I'll put you on the spot first. Just thinking about, like, I thought it was really nice having the opportunity to check in with people once a month, even though over the summer it was very chaotic for me and I missed a couple sessions, but it was nice. I think it deepened talking about a kind of difficult topic, but on what writer a lot of us like, it was for me a really nice experience to deepen some friendships and relationships. So yeah, how was it for all of you guys? I'll let Tiffany go first.
I really liked it. I feel like Doomer Optimism has been kind of my gateway into finding the other people in my region. You know, I've come across like Peter Allen and his farm in the Driftless, and you know, all the work that he's doing, and a lot of other really great people through this podcast. But
and we've met,
we've had dinner, yeah, and hung out together, bathed together,
yeah.
You know, just you know, I feel like there's a lot of good connections happening, and so I really appreciated this opportunity to just find more people in the area, and kind of took advantage of that. We started a Hilo group. I know they have, you know, an Appalachia Hilo group going, and now and we've got the Midwest one going. And so I see a lot of potential there. And so I've been experimenting a lot with that and trying to get more people to communicate and really work in that space, you know, amongst all these other platforms that we have to connect and everything. But so I see a lot of potential and very hopeful about those things coming together.
Nice. Well, I know once I get to Chicago, I'll bring some Midwest supremacy to the Doomer Optimism project. Joel?
Yeah, similar. Just regularly enjoyed getting together with a couple other people once a month to talk about Wendell Berry. Was pretty fun. I wish the West was a close, you know, my two other group members were in far, far away. You never know when you'll meet each other, but the odds of us getting together on the ground are pretty slim at the moment.
Yeah.
And Gutierrez is about to move to New York, I guess. So.
It's been
it was great.
Good. It's been announced on Twitter, Donald, that Keturah and Andy are engaged. So it's the cat's out of the bag on that one. So that's good. Donald, any reflections, meta reflections about the book club?
Should we do one? It's a real good group. Wish we could all have done it on like around a kitchen table or on a porch or something.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm getting more and more sick of the Zoom stuff, although love you all, love to be able to do the podcast, but it is an alienating thing. AC?
Yeah, I think it was awesome for me. It was awesome to be part of the super group. I mean, there wasn't anybody I didn't already know a little bit. So it was great to really deepen relationships. You know, I came to Twitter maybe naively enough, but to come have constructive disagreements with people. I never really mentioned this before, but I used to be, before I came to Twitter, I used to be really involved in like a Facebook community called Mixed Mental Arts. So if you're familiar with the comedian Brian Callen, he had this podcast called Mixed Mental Arts. And the whole idea was, you know, to have constructive disagreements, like not a shootout discussion where you're trying to literally like kill your opponent, but a mixed mental arts, you know, jiu-jitsu type argument where you're able to like respectfully grapple with issues. And that sort of group went defunct. And again, one of the reasons I came to Twitter, like I liked talking about these issues constructively, and there was no other outlet for it. And so I came to Twitter, found this Doomer Optimism community. You know, Ashley, you were kind enough to let me on the podcast and meet some great people in real life. And, you know, our group, as I said at the beginning, you know, we definitely came from geographically diverse perspectives, politically diverse perspectives, racially diverse perspectives, although, you know, all of us were of the same, you know, group, so to speak. But it was just really good to tackle a very, what would otherwise, you know, unfortunately be in our common day, a very hot button divisive issue. And we were able to have a really, really deep conversation that had a lot of mutual respect for each other. So it was a fantastic experience. This was also my first book club, so I didn't really know what to expect. And I think that was fun. I hope we can do more of these. Ashley, we'll have to find another book to jump on, because I think there's clearly a hunger for it. I mean, 150 some odd people reached out to you expressing interest. So hopefully we can keep that momentum going with a new topic.
Yeah, I'm sure Donald has a list. He always has a list of books for me to read. And every time we talk, I feel guilty that I haven't read them yet. So we can do another book club. I'm open to whatever. And I'm also just open to, I feel like I'm kind of like the conduit of noticing when there's like momentum. Enough people kept tagging me about this Wendell Berry book that I'm like, all right, fine, I'll organize something. And so a similar kind of thing, if there seems to be some kind of momentum or topic or thing people want to do, get together, you know, meetups or some sort of activity, I'm always open. Final thoughts, Donald, were you going to say something?
No, I talked enough already. Thanks,
okay. Joel wants your book list. You do not want his book list, Joel. You do not want his book list. It's too long. He's the most insatiable reader. But yeah, Donald, you can put together a book list for us for Joel, and I'll share it on Twitter if you want.
It sounds like we would get along then.
You two should be friends then. Although Donald on Twitter, you can find his email in this organization email. All right. So anyways, this was really fun. Thanks everyone for showing up and taking up the invitation to do this book club. I thought it was a kind of a tough, it wasn't really just like a, you know, completely in agreement discussion. I agree with AC that it felt really generative to disagree. I feel like everybody now is just walking on eggshells so much in terms of disagreement. So it was kind of nice to like flex those muscles and disagree politely and still remain friends. And so hopefully we do more of that in Doomer Optimism and the larger sphere. So anyways,
I want to say one last thing, actually.
Yeah.
To issue a challenge, which is that you should all write letters to the people that you were in the book club with.
Okay.
Pen and paper.
Okay. Yeah. Okay. We'll issue that challenge. Write a letter, and everyone who is in a book club, write letters to people in your book club. I believe there's some people in Doomer Optimism starting some pen pal snail mail exchanges. Wayne from Twitter just puts his address out and just receives cards from
people. I don't even know who that guy is, but I wrote his address down.
Oh, you did? Yeah, he's in Iowa, and he's just like received another postcard. So I don't know, I'm not gonna do that, but I might get ask people privately for their addresses, I want start writing more. I think it's nice. And also write to Wendell Berry, because he often writes back. So
Box 1 in Henry County, Kentucky.
Yeah. And I know AC, you received a letter back from him, right?
I did, yeah. When I wrote my poem and I was trying to get it published, I reached out to him just looking for guidance, and I can't remember, he wrote me back a beautiful handwritten letter and basically said agents were of no use for him, so he didn't have any good advice for me. But it was a sweet letter nonetheless. And then I would also plug, if you're going to order books, order from the Wendell Berry bookstore, because you'll also get a nice little handwritten note from Emily, who's the store manager. So it's a support them.
Yeah, and I think his granddaughter runs it. I don't know if that's who Emily is, but yeah, it's like in his family, which is really sweet. So, all right. Well, thank you all for showing up, for talking about this. Sorry we lost Keturah. She had technical issues. But yeah, this was fun. We'll post it in a couple of weeks. Bye, everybody. Thanks.